This week's episode of A Cast of Kings is brought to you by Casper. Get $50 off any mattress purchase by visiting casper.com/acastofkings and using promo code acastofkings. That's casper.com/acastofkings and using promo code acastofkings. Jonah, how do you think the bedding in Game of Thrones was? What do you think they probably used for the beds in Game of Thrones?
God,
maybe down is my guess.
Down's a good guess. I was about to say straw
or down. Yeah. Probably pretty uncomfortable compared to mattress technology today. Would recommend you check out one of Casper's awesome mattresses at casper.com/acastofkings and use promo code acastofkings to get $50 off any mattress purchase. Hello, everyone, and welcome to A Cast of Kings, an unofficial podcast about the HBO original series Game of Thrones. I'm David Chen.
I'm Joanna Robinson.
And both of us are reading A Game of Thrones from George R.R. Martin's A Song of Ice and Fire. This week, we are going to be covering Season 1, Episode 1, Winter is Coming, from Game of Thrones. You can find more episodes of this podcast at GameofThronesPodcast.com. You can also email us at acastofkings@gmail.com. That's acastofkings@gmail.com. Also, if you want to comment on this episode, find us at Facebook at facebook.com/acastofkings. So, Jonah Robinson, I never thought I'd be doing this show with you in the off season, but here we are. And rewatching Game of Thrones Season 1, which is a season that I think has remained my favorite throughout all the years.
Oh, wow. We'll see if that's true.
Yeah, the question is whether it holds up or not. I'm eager to find out. For this episode, we watched Season 1, Episode 1. We also read through Daenerys' second chapter in the book, Game of Thrones. And so if you want to follow along, watch episode one, read through about 100 pages of A Game of Thrones, Daenerys chapter two. This episode was directed by Tim Van Patten, who did a bunch of Sopranos episodes, a bunch of Boardwalk Empire episodes, hasn't really come back to the series in later seasons of Game of Thrones, right?
Yeah.
They've really kind of done their own thing. They're a lot of directors, like Neil Marshall, he's not doing the show anymore either. So they're really kind of, I feel like, developing their own talent. You know, they're doing their own thing. They're doing kind of new things each season.
Well, they rotate in and out. You know, they've got a couple people. They usually have like a couple directors that overlap, and then they'll bring in like two new directors or something like that.
Right. Yeah. So, but they obviously have it down to a science at this point.
Yeah.
At this early point during episode one, they were, you know, according to Brian Cogman when he was on our show, they were still kind of figuring out how to do this show, how to shoot this show, what the show would actually be. Game of Thrones is currently one of the most successful cable television shows of all time, but it's easy to forget that when this episode was first released, there was no assurance that it would last past the first season, right? I mean, it's very easy, like looking back on it, it's hard to even imagine a world where Game of Thrones is not a cultural phenomenon, but back at the time, I mean, I remember Emilia Clarke was saying in interviews how she never thought that this show would be a success, or she wouldn't have guessed that it would have been.
I mean, the TV, you know, it's harder to imagine now because the TV, like the TV landscape, is so full of Game of Thrones knockoffs that it doesn't seem so weird. But it was a bit of an outlier when it first started, and it got pasted in the New York Times review. There was a like really, really negative Slate.com review. Yeah, there were just a bunch of really negative reviews that a bunch of the book readers, I remember very, very distinctly when those reviews came out, because the book readers who love the series were just so outraged at this. They felt like the show was being dismissed as stupid, Ren Faire, you know, D&D fantasy stuff. So, yeah.
So
genre shows can work, man. They can.
Apparently so. But yeah, it is just remarkable to think of how far this show has come in the meantime. So anyway, for the first time ever on A Cast of Kings, I am reading the books along. But we're primarily going to discuss this as a show and kind of talk about some of the book elements here and there. So Let's get into it then. So let's start with the very first scene. So this is one of the few episodes in the entire series that has a cold open. Actually, did it have a cold open?
Yeah, this episode? Yeah.
Yeah, it did. It was a cold open, which is basically something that happens before the main title sequence, which generally never happens. Generally, it's previously on Game of Thrones and then main title sequence. But this had a cold open. And what an effective cold open it was, right?
Yeah. So
basically, we see three rangers. They're looking for a wildling village, right? And
right.
And then they're attacked by White Walkers.
Right. I promise I'm probably not going to go too much into the history of HBO and Game of Thrones when it came out, but this is the scene that they released before, you know, they teased this online before this show premiered a couple weeks before, and you know, book readers just lost their minds because it looked so great.
Right.
And it still looks great. I mean, the White Walkers now are obviously quite different in design than they were in that first scene, but I mean, it's just the tension's there. It's beautifully shot. The wall looks amazing.
Yep.
I mean, it looks really incredible. The dead bodies arranged and design, it's all very atmospheric right off the bat.
So I'm going to point out some very basic things about, you know, the implications of adaptation. And my observations on this front will probably get less and less as time goes on. But it is a very – so I'll just confess that I generally don't read fiction books. Like, it just is a – in general, I just don't read fiction books and therefore deprive myself of a lot of culture. I generally just prefer nonfiction. So that's why I never read fiction. So this is – I haven't read a fiction book in probably years. So this is my first kind of fiction book in a very long time. And in reading it, I'm struck by a lot of different things that I'm impressed with and also that I just never even occurred to me, right? And one of the things that is very basic is in a book, generally, any minor character needs a name of some kind.
Yeah.
Right? That in a show, there's like extras and background artists, and you might never know what their names are. But it's just weird in a book if anyone has a speaking part to just say this guy or the horseman. Like, that actually draws more attention to it than if you actually just give them a name that never shows up again.
Right.
Right. So I did find that was interesting. All these people get names in the book, and they might have names in the show, but they're not certainly not prominent names or names that we remember. Right.
Right. And I mean, yeah, and not only names, but you know, they all get a backstory. And
right.
the thing that George R. R. Martin does, I want to say in each of his books, yeah, in each of his books is there's a prologue with a narrator that you don't, that isn't a main character.
Mm-hmm.
That's like a trick he uses in every single book. And oftentimes that character doesn't make it out of the prologue alive. But yeah, so you're dropped in this world. You meet all these characters in the prologue. You're like, okay, got it. Waymar Royce. Okay, he's this guy. Okay, I got it. And then he's dead and it doesn't matter. And you're like, oh, okay.
Yeah, well, that was pointless.
But those are like the joys and then also the drag of George R. R. Martin, because he will give backstories to every character. He's obsessive. There was a This American Life this week where you heard George R. R. Martin talking about J.R. Tolkien, and what made his universes so compelling was the obsessive detail. And obviously Martin has picked that up from Tolkien and just given obsessive detail to his books. And that can make them rich and it can make them drag at the same time. So,
right.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's some minor differences here in terms of what actually happened here and what's in the books. In the books, all three of them die, right?
No.
Oh, okay.
Never it's just mind. The old man gets out, like the younger one dies, and it's the old man who's captured by the Stark men and beheaded by Ned later.
Oh, really? Okay, all right.
Because they mention how he has no ears in the prologue, and then the man that Ned beheads later has no ears. So
I see, but they don't – do they draw the connection explicitly in the book?
I think just because he has no ears.
Gotcha. I may have missed that detail, so I betray my very poor attention to detail. I'm clearly not very good at reading quite yet.
But I mean, yeah, the young guy makes it out. The youngest guy makes it out in the show, and the oldest guy makes it out in the book. But the result is the same. They get beheaded for fleeing from, you know, the others, the White Walkers.
Gotcha. So then we get main title sequence.
Mm-hmm.
And
with a bunch of names of actors who aren't on the show.
I just thought it was so funny to see all those actors again, and how Peter Dinklage is last billed on the show. It's like 50 names and then and Peter Dinklage at the end. And now I believe he is first bill on the show, if I recall correctly. He's kind of one – he's the first, if not one of the first names that appears in the opening credits.
I think – but I think isn't the and also sort of a – if you're not first, the and is also a place of honor?
Correct.
So I remember like Heather Locklear was – and Heather Locklear in Melrose Place for like 4 years.
Right, right. It's not. So, it's not as though he's the last, the least most, the least famous person or anything.
It's like last but not least. Peter
right.
Dinklage.
Exactly. Yeah. It just. It did feel. It was just interesting to see. Wow. Oh my gosh. All these awesome actors used to be on this show.
Yeah.
So then, in the show, right, the next scene, this beautiful sequence of these horses riding over this this hill and capturing the deserter.
Right.
And one thing we should just say is I'm impressed by – reading the book, I'm impressed by so many things about the show. Firstly, you know, on a very basic level, the idea that someone read all this and figured out a way to make everything look distinct and different and so on. Like, it just is incredible.
Yeah.
And the season one is so beautiful and is shot in, you know, such lovely locations. And another thing, and we can talk about this more later, is how there are, as you mentioned, so many characters. It's so rich. And the showrunners needed to kind of understand on some basic level who might become important later. Right. So they be sure to include them, right? Or if they didn't include them, they need to figure out a way to get around that. The mind boggles at how they were able to distill all of this content into what we see as a show. And it hasn't always been successful. But overall, I'm just so like so much more impressed with the show now, having read this book and realizing that these guys who made the show came up with it out of this book.
You sound so down on the book, but like what I will say is that it's really interesting to read this first part of the book and watch the first episode because yes, they do some condensing, yes, highlighting specific things, but it's also at this point almost a page-by-page adaption.
At this point.
You know?
At this point.
At this point.
At this point.
It actually they had to get like a lot more complicated. But
A lot of the dialogue is taken verbatim, for instance, right? Mm-hmm. Although the thing is they do trim out a lot of the – like they obviously have less dialogue in the show than there is dialogue in the book. And they trim out a lot of the dialogue in the book. And I'm so impressed by how strategic they are at trimming it out. Most of the time when they make a cut down, it makes it better, in my opinion. And we can talk more about those instances later. I didn't mean to be down on the book. I just meant reading this book, like the task of adaptation feels insurmountable to me.
Yeah.
It's a great book. I'm just saying – and it's very easy. It's a good read. It's easy to read. It's not, you know, dense or anything. I mean, there are a lot of backstory. And I would say that if I didn't watch a show, I would probably find the book incredibly challenging. But it's an easy read. And it just is so many details. And how do you keep them all straight? And how do you, you know, create these things out of, you know, basically thin air? It's incredible. So we meet all the Starks. And then Ned beheads the deserter. This scene of meeting all the Starks is basically a fabrication for the show, right? I mean, I don't think that actually happened in the book.
No, it doesn't. I mean, like a little bit of like the Sansa Arya sewing scene transplanted in there. But for the most part, yeah, it's just really effective. Boom, boom, boom. These are these kids. You know, Arya is the sassy one. Bran is, you know, the young one. Sansa's the perfect princess. You know, like all of this. It's really effective, you know, character work right off the bat.
I do think that one thing that the show does pretty well, I would give it a B+, A- at this, is this is a pilot for a series. But in general, the characters, even despite this incredibly expansive world, in general, most of the time, the characters speak as though they are actually in that situation, right? And what I mean by that is you don't have a lot of expository dialogue of, oh, hey, brother, let me tell you my backstory, even though there's no reason that I would do that, you know?
Yeah.
In general, I found it all very organic, perhaps to a fault, in the sense that it's just very difficult to keep these characters and their names straight and their relationships to each other straight.
I guess, but I mean, when you compare it to meeting the Sand Snakes – this last season, which I think was just the other side of the coin of something Game of Thrones did really well right here, introduce you to all the Starks. But when they introduce you to Oberyn's daughters, it's just like they're trying really hard to give them distinct personalities and failing, and also burdening us with like this whole speech from Obara about their life and their backstory and all this sort of stuff. And it just doesn't work in any way.
You're still really bitter about those Sans things.
I am.
But yeah. But yeah, I think what you're saying is that it totally works in this episode of the show.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I agree. I just think, again, like I said, almost to a fault, it's very good at making these characters speak in an organic way and being very faithful to the book. And it doesn't really hold your hand. The show doesn't hold your hand that much, I would say. And for that reason, some people might have found it confusing and off-putting, but I think it's to the show's credit, and it kind of just lets you figure things out.
You understand why I did it?
John said he was a deserter.
But do you understand why I had to kill him?
Our way is the old way.
The man who passes the sentence should swing the sword.
Is it Trace or the White Walkers?
The White Walkers have been gone for thousands of years.
So he was lying.
The madman sees what he sees.
Ned beheads the deserter, and then they find the direwolves. And foreshadowing that I didn't realize the first time around, Joanna, which is that a stag has stabbed this direwolf in the throat. I think, and they're both dead.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, there's no reason why I would understand. Even in the book, you have a better understanding of the direwolf.
That's because they hit it like three times really hard in the book. Catelyn's like, and remember that stag that killed that direwolf on their own. You're like, we get it, Catelyn.
Here, it's just a throwaway shot in the in the show, and you know they put a lot of work into making this. I assume fake. Stag and fake direwolf, and they're just like, it's a nice little book Easter egg, right?
Yeah.
That if you know the house sigil of Lannisters, you'll understand the significance.
Baratheon.
Baratheon, yeah.
Yeah.
You'll understand what's going on there.
Right.
And the scene is really faithful to the book. I think it's pretty much exactly.
And the direwolf pups are so cute.
They are very adorable. And what I liked is actually how the show conveys how quickly the direwolves age. Because there's basically a scene later where Catelyn says, oh, I forgot how quickly these things grow. And I don't think that's – in the book you understand that, but do they say that explicitly like that? I mean you just understand that they get bigger really quickly in the book, right?
Yeah. I mean, from where we read so far in the book, they haven't mentioned them growing. So it might just be a logistics thing if they didn't want to have puppies around. So they're like, let's switch to teen wolves at this point. I don't know.
Well, also, spoiler for episode two, but, you know, a dire wolf makes a significant, you know, rescue in that. So they needed to figure out a way to say, like, hey, these dire wolves. Another thing is, were they just huge to begin with in the book? Right.
No. I mean, the little puppy fit inside Bran's like shirt.
Yeah.
You know.
You're right.
But also just the passage of time. It helps also convey how long it takes the royals to get from King's Landing to Winterfell. Now, Littlefinger can get from King's Landing to Winterfell and back again or whatever in a day. But I think if they say it took them like a month,
it took
to
them
get
a
there.
Month. They've been riding for a month.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, the direwolves grow up and grow up pretty fast in a month. It's also good introduction to Theon. You know, in the book, he like kicks a beheaded head, which is just a little too much. But here, you know, he draws a sword on a puppy. So, you know, you're already like, oh, okay, Theon, whoever you are.
Well, in general, threatening puppies. All the characters have been aged upward in general.
Yeah. Yes. Yes.
And I think it's a benefit to the show.
Yes.
Of course.
I agree.
If you had – well, firstly, it would be logistically impossible to make the show with 12-year-olds that stayed – you know, that aged very little as the books progress, right?
Right.
But I think, they behave – it's a lot more difficult to take some of these lines as seriously if it's coming out of like a ninth grader's mouth. Do you know what I mean? There's this scene, I hate skipping ahead, but there's a scene in episode two where the, you know, Catelyn is really beside herself with grief, and Maester Luwin is saying, oh, hey, we need to figure out how we're going to settle these accounts and appoint these people. And Rob says, like, I'll handle it. And it's really great the way it's played in the show, but I feel like it wouldn't have been as impactful if it was a kid saying that line. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, because he's 14.
Yeah, if he's 14 and he's saying it, it's just like, okay, you know, you're basically – I wouldn't be able to get out of my head that he's playing house, essentially. But maybe that's just because I'm ageist. I don't know. anyway, how do we want to do this? I guess typically we talk through each plot line individually, but I think it's good to bounce around in this episode.
Yeah, just right? The way this one's structured.
It's structured, right. So then we flash to King's Landing and the throne room, which is, I should say, a set that I don't feel like we've seen a lot of in the last couple of years.
Yeah. I feel like it was like when Oberyn was talking to Varys. Did we even get the throne room this year?
I don't know. I don't recall any throne room scenes this past year, but maybe I'm wrong about that.
We haven't seen Tommen sitting on the throne at all.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure we must have at some point.
It's mostly in kind of the Tywin's chambers or the small council chambers. That's kind of become the surrogate, the proxy for the throne room these days. But yeah, that's an impressive set. And what's also impressive is just how much of the look of the show is established in this episode. A look that – and a production design that's pretty closely followed for the following 5 years. I mean, even as early as this episode, what are those people that – with the little flags above their heads when the people are dead?
Oh, I think they're called like the Silent Sisters.
The Silent Sisters, like right. That. So that whole – look is established in this episode.
Oh, yeah, and the rocks over the eyes.
The rocks over the eyes. It all is kind of built in this, and they just keep returning to it in subsequent seasons. And it's impressive to see exactly how much groundwork was laid in this episode.
One thing I will say is that the female hairstyles, this has always struck me when I watched season one, the female hairstyles were radically changed in season two.
Uh-huh.
Like, they were just like, these wigs look dumb. It's mostly like with the court ladies. They've got these really stupid hair that Sansa wears later. And then basically in season two, they're like, forget it. We're not doing this anymore. They look done. Sorry about that. We'll pretend it was like a year-long phase in King's Landing and the ladies are not doing that anymore.
So in this scene, Jaime and Cersei are introduced. We see them for the first time. And by the way, screenwriting tip, if you ever want to introduce characters and their relationship to each other, just have them call each other by their relationship to each other. Like, hey, sister, because that's something that you conceivably could say and also is something that helps the audience.
Have you ever said, I mean, I feel like unless you're Buster Bluth, you don't say, hey, brother. Like, do you ever say, hey, brother?
I say, hey, brother, sometimes.
I never say, hey, sister, to my sister.
Even ironically, though. People do it ironically sometimes. And it seems that, you know, that maybe he was doing it in this scene. In any case, they're talking about Jon Arryn, what he knows. And you don't really know, like, what they're talking about at this point. What is this horrible secret that Jon Arryn knows?
Right.
And Jaime's saying, hey, if he blabbed to anyone, we'd already be dead. Basically.
Right.
So,
as your brother, I feel it's my duty to warn you. You worry too much. It's starting to show.
And you never worry about anything. When we were seven, you jumped off the cliffs at Castle Rock. 100-foot drop into the water. You were never afraid.
There was nothing to be afraid of until you told Father.
Lannisters don't act like fools.
What if Jon Arryn told someone?
But who would he tell?
My husband.
If he told the king, both our heads would be skewered in the city gates by now. Whatever Jon Arryn knew or didn't know, it died with him. And Robert will choose a new hand of the king, someone to do his job while he's off fucking balls and hunting whores. Or is it the other way around? And life will go on.
You should be the hand of the king.
That's a none I can do without. The days are too long. The lives are too short.
Good introduction.
Dun, dun, dun. Yeah.
Very ominous. And of course, Jon Arryn's death is kind of the inciting incident that sets all the pieces into motion.
Right.
So then back at Winterfell, Catelyn tells Ned that Jon Arryn is dead. In the book, we get a little bit more backstory about Jon Arryn, right? That Jon right. Arryn's kind of like a father to Ned. They were raised...
and Robert,
They were raised, I want to say, at The Eerie? Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, so they're obviously very close, and you get a little bit more of that in the book. To the book's credit, I think. I mean, I think you don't really feel the impact. I mean, I'll say, when watching the show, you barely, at least for me, I barely comprehended how these people are. Who is John Aaron? How are these people connected in any way? I having seen these episodes many times and read the book, I still don't fully comprehend it. So, but now, you know, having read the book, now I understand a little bit more that how important he was to Ned and how agonizing it must have been for Ned to make that decision.
Right.
So then Catelyn and Maester Luwin prepare for the royal visit, and I love how in the book they give a shout-out to how logistically challenging it would be to host, what is it, 1,000 people?
Yeah.
And so you wrote Tyrion exposition here in the show notes, Joanna Robinson. What's that about?
Well, just, you know, she's like, you know, it's a good scene because it's like them getting ready for the visit, but it's also her saying, make sure there are a lot of candles in Lord Tyrion's room. He likes to read into the night. I hear he likes to drink too. Yes, that's so funny for a man so small. So you learn that Tyrion is short, likes to read, and likes to drink in like this quick scene between Catelyn and Maester Luwin. And it's done really organically as they're like walking through, you know, the feasting room, and you see everyone just like busily putting things together. Right. And that's beautiful, like background.
So much. And that's what I love about this season and the show in general is like there's so, or now I love it, is there's so much economy to how they convey all this information in a way that seems organic. And really, really great work there. Then there's a scene that I believe is invented for the show where we see Rob, John, and Theon shirtless.
Yeah.
Did that happen?
in
the book? I don't think so, right? So good stuff. Good stuff.
Did it crack you up, the stuff about Kit Harington's hair? Like, since Kit Harington's hair is like the big subject of the summer.
Clearly foreshadowing.
Yes.
A lot of foreshadowing what's going to happen 5 years later. Good stuff. Good stuff. And then we see some hint of Bran climbing the wall. Now, I forget, in the book, I feel like he was the climbing led into him. Like, we don't, quote-unquote, see him climbing before he actually sees Cersei and Jaime, is
right. There's just like a throwaway line from Catelyn to Ned, like when he says he's going to take Bran with him to King's Landing. She's like, try to keep him off the walls. You know he likes to climb. But then we get the whole Bran chapter leading him to his fall where he talks about how he likes to climb. Like, there's a whole chapter, right, about Bran talking about all the ways he climbs around Winterfell. So you know that this is a thing he does. And I think the show is very smart to sort of just plant that earlier scene so we get that climbing is a thing that's important to Bran, you know, because it just makes it more poignant later when he can't walk. That Bran was always the one who liked to scramble all over everything, and now he's immobilized. So,
well, what was cool, I like this. It's very simple, very simple. What happened in the show, but in the book, there's this whole thing about Bran saying, "Oh, I really like climbing," blah blah blah. And one time, Mother told me to promise never to climb again, but I was actually lying and blah, blah, blah. And in the show, it happens in, you know, 10 seconds. It's
exactly.
Like,
plus, he spots like the royal van approaching. So it's like it does double duty.
There's actually some function to the climbing. Yeah. So just brilliant kind of screenwriting there, compressing all that into a very short scene when she makes him promise to never climb again. And she says, I always know when you're lying, blah, blah, blah. It's a nice little moment between the two of them.
Mm-hmm.
So then they all arrive, and it's fascinating to conceive of a time when Joffrey Baratheon might have been considered sexually desirable in some way. Something his stock would plummet dramatically starting season episode 2. But for this episode, you know, there was nothing really about Joffrey that we might have disliked, other than that
he doesn't have a line in this episode, right?
I don't think he says anything, right?
Yeah.
In the book, I think he's a little bit more douchey.
You get that fencing scene.
Right, there's a fencing scene. Yeah.
Dick. Yeah.
Which I, by the way, I think is basically substituted by a scene, I want to say in episode 2, where Jaime is a dick to Jon. I feel like that was kind of a stand-in for Lannisters being dicks to the Starks.
Gotcha.
But anyway, what were you going to say?
Well, also, I was struck when I was reading the book that it says Cersei's wagon was not only like a double decker, but pulled by 40 horses. It's like, and the show's like, yeah, how about
like two horses?
Two. We can do two. And also Jamie's look is just so funny in this episode. I mean, you know, if you watch this on HBO Go, this is the thumbnail for the episode, is Jamie is this like golden prince, and he just looks so dumb, compared to like, you know, the slightly more rakish look he has now. So, right. He just looks too golden, like too.
I thought it was fine. I didn't have that reaction.
No, not in a bad, I mean, like in an intentional way, like he's supposed to look like that, but you're just like, wow, Jamie. Okay. You know, there was that meme that went around where he looked like the prince from Shrek. Do you remember that? Anyway.
Yeah, I can see that. I'll take your word for it, J-Rob.
Okay.
So I like how this episode and these chapters kind of play off the fairy tale tropes of Sansa being kind of in the boonies. And oh my gosh, not only is she not going to be the boonies anymore, she's going to become a princess.
Yeah.
That is a major upgrade.
Yeah.
I think... one of the greatest things about watching this episode again is so many things become more resonant now that you know everything that happens to these characters after the fact. And not only that, learning basic backstory, like how Winterfell is in the middle of nowhere. Like, you don't really understand how, at least I didn't understand kind of how far away Winterfell, how isolated Winterfell is from everything else, and how close it is to the north and how cold it is and so on and so forth. Obviously, all that stuff is in the map during the opening credits, but you know, after 50 some odd episodes, now I truly feel like I understand the relationship between these places in this world. And
because it takes a month to get there, man.
It takes a month to get there. So yeah, I really feel like this whole idea of Sansa wanting to become a princess is a great head fake. Because it's definitely not going to play out how she wants.
Or Bran wanting to become, I mean, that's in the books, but Bran wanting to become a knight.
Right.
It's so important to him, you know? And it's like, this is not going to happen for you, Stark children. Sorry. What was I going to say? Oh, and just the idea of, like, if King's Landing is a month's ride away from Winterfell, which it no longer is in the show, but as it was in the first episode, it means Ned leaving means that basically he and Catelyn will never see each other. When he's like, Catelyn, you stay here, I gotta go. That's like, we're getting a divorce, basically. You know, it's crazy. So,
well, you know, maybe he serves out his term. Maybe after a decade, they see each other. I would say it's more like a jail term rather than a divorce.
I guess.
Well, like, you're gonna be
trial
away
trial separation.
Really, yeah, you're gonna be away for a long time, and then maybe you come back. So,
tour of duty. Okay, sorry. A
couple more things happen in Winterfell. We have Tyrion and Roz, your favorite character, Roz, who I believe is introduced performing fellatio on Tyrion, right?
Yes, yes. We hear her before
we see her. We don't see it, but we hear it.
It is true what they say about the northern gales.
Did you hear the kings in Winterfell?
I did hear something about that.
And the queen, and her twin brother. They say that he is the most handsome man in the Seven Kingdoms.
The other brother?
The queen has two brothers.
There's the pretty one. And there's the clever one.
I hear they call him the imp.
I hear he hates that nickname.
Oh? I hear he's more than earned it. I hear he's a drunken little lecher, prone to all manner of perversions.
Clever girl.
We've been expecting you, Lord Tyrion.
Have you?
Already?
The gods gave me one blessing.
This is a great intro to Tyrion. Was this in the book?
No.
I don't recall it being in the book. So it's just a great way to introduce Tyrion as a character, as the guy who has some of the best lines in the show, as an alcoholic whoremonger, basically. And so very, very nicely done.
Clever alcoholic whoremonger.
There you go. And so great scene, very funny. And then there's.
But this is where the show begins. I mean,
we can't. Right? We would be remiss if we didn't.
Well,
mention.
This is where the show, like, yes, we got Kit Harington, Alfie Allen, and Richard Madden with their shirts off. But we get Roz fully naked, and we get Amelia Clark fully naked in this episode, and neither of those things happen in the book.
Hmm.
So, you know, that's just, you know, this is what it's right here in episode one.
Flesh.
The pedigree of Game of Thrones. Okay.
The die is cast for the rest of the show. The sins of the fathers have been visited upon the sons, starting with the first episode. Yeah. So then we get a very exposition heavy scene between Ned and Robert.
Yes.
Where they explain, again, I remember watching this for the first time. You kind of only get the very basics, which is that, or I only understood the very basics, which is that Robert loved Lyanna, Ned's sister. Was it Rhaegar Targaryen?
It was Rhaegar
murdered, Targaryen. Lyanna. And
he didn't murder her.
Okay.
He kidnapped her, and she died. And so Robert blames Rhaegar for her death. And that's what led to Robert's rebellion and him taking the throne away from the Targaryens and killing Rhaegar and all of that.
Gotcha. So this is a really nice scene. The crypt is nicely designed, and they have this, you know, the rituals of Westeros of, you know, placing this feather on the statue. I guess that's a thing, right?
That's weird.
Yeah. You get a really nice sense of the relationship. And also, this is when Robert asks Ned to become his hand, I believe. Right?
Yeah.
Is that right?
And says that Joffrey should marry Sansa.
Right. And I guess they're just like, oh, well, I guess that's going to work. So Ned reluctantly agrees.
Yeah.
Tell me about Jon Arryn.
One minute he was fine, and then burned right through him, whatever it was. I loved that man.
We both did.
He never had to teach you much, but me. You remember me at 16? All I wanted to do was crack skulls and fuck girls. He showed me what was what.
Aye.
Don't look at me like that. It's not his fault I didn't listen.
I need you, Ned. Down at King's Landing, not up here where you're no damn use to anybody. Lord Eddard Stark, I would name you the Hand of the King.
I'm not worthy of the honor.
I'm not trying to honor you. I'm trying to get you to run my kingdom while I eat, drink, and haul my way to an early grave. Damn it, Ned, stand up.
And we talked about this on the episode air this year, but, you know, Sophie Turner Sansa picked up that feather this past season, season 5 in Game of Thrones.
Mm.
She's down in the crypt, and she found the feather by Lyanna's statue. So that was a nice callback to
very good
season 1.
Very good. So we have a scene in Pentos, right? The first time we see Pentos.
Yeah.
And we meet Viserys and Dany, and the conversation is very similar to the one in the book. I will say that this idea of waking the dragon is far more prominent and more silly in the book.
Oh, you think it's silly? Okay.
I just think if he kept referring to waking the dragon in the show, it would have come off as very... I like the way they did it in the show, because
yeah.
If he had just kept saying, don't wake the dragon, you're waking the dragon, you know, if he had kept saying those things, it would have been very distracting, and it would have been more difficult to take him seriously, I think.
Gotcha. No, I agree. I think the scene was really well done. I actually kind of miss Viserys. And I liked that character a lot. And the great Harry Lloyd, rest in peace. Not the actor. Okay, anyway, the other point being, I liked the cut too, because you've got Ned and Robert doing a lot of heavy exposition, but, you know, Ned's basically like, don't worry about the Targaryens, they're gone. And Robert's like, not all of them.
Right.
And it's cut to Amelia Clark, which
very good.
I really liked, you know, so.
And yeah, this is a great scene. Viserys, I think what was interesting about the book, I will say this about the book that I didn't get in the show, is you don't really understand, at least I didn't from watching the show, how Dany didn't completely buy into what Viserys was saying. at this point, I felt like I have no idea who Dany is. Maybe she's super naive. Maybe she thinks Viserys might be telling the truth. Who knows? But in the book, she is far more skeptical of Viserys' claims.
Yeah, and I don't know if it's like a limitation of Emilia Clarke's acting in this early stage in her career, or, you know, if they just wrote her as kind of a blank slate. But yeah, you get a lot more personality from, because you're in her side of her head in the book, right? You just get a lot more of a personality because she has to put up this front so as not to wake the dragon, right? So, you know, we just see the front. We don't see what's going on inside of her. I thought the hot bath was pretty great. You know, she just walks in and like the servants are like, it's too hot. And she's like, whatevs.
there's a very similar scene in the book as well. Right.
She's like, I love my bath.
My bath's hot. It's not as doesn't feel as extreme as it does in the show.
The thing we haven't mentioned yet, you've watched episode two recently, it sounds like, so you might know, but I forget when they stopped doing this, but the place titles that they put over like Winterfell.
Yeah, I don't think they do that in episode two.
So it's just a pilot.
Just a pilot thing, yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
So anyway, so that's Pentos, and we're going to go back to there. But before that, some more scenes in Winterfell. Sansa and Catelyn talk about Joffrey, and Sansa gets super jazzed about marrying Joffrey. So we already talked about that. And then they have this huge feast. Now, as I mentioned, logistically, it would be really difficult to host hundreds, if not thousands, of Kingsmen, right?
Right.
I mean, you'd need like 1,000 beds, Joanna, and that's that's difficult to come by, right?
Yeah,
I mean it's difficult. It's difficult enough for people to come across one bed.
Since beds are so like bulky and hard to transport.
Hard to transport. It's a pain in the butt to shop for them.
Yeah,
and a lot of the times you buy them and you're not happy with them. And what are you going to do? Return the bed?
Return a bed. You slept on it.
You slept on it. You got to cart it back. Logistically, just think through it. It's going to be really challenging. Fortunately, ladies and gentlemen, there is a solution for all these problems. Casper.com/acastofkings. That's Casper.com/acastofkings. Use promo code acastofkings to get $50 off any mattress purchase. So what is Casper? They are an online retailer of premium mattresses for a fraction of the price. When you go to a mattress store, you're not just paying for the mattress. You're paying for the showroom, for the guy who's selling you the mattress. Mattress prices are really insane. But Casper Mattress is, they strip down all the overhead. They send you a mattress in a box, and it's an incredible experience. You cut it open, it like inflates, you know, like it just springs open like a jack in the box. And
like those little dinosaur sponges you used to put in the bath.
Exactly right. And it, from a little capsule, yeah, it becomes a dinosaur. Exactly. Proportionally, Casper Mattress is the same concept. most mattresses can cost well over $1,500, but Casper mattresses cost between $500 for a twin size and $950 for a king size.
Wow.
$950 for a king size. That is a really good deal. And if you use Casper.com/acastofkings and use promo code acastofkings, you get $50 off your first mattress purchase. Not only that, totally risk-free. They offer you free delivery and returns within a 100-day period. So it's super easy to return if you want to get rid of it. There's basically no reason not to go with a Casper mattress if you are, you know, anywhere other than completely satisfied with your current bed. So we'd highly recommend them. They are one of the sponsors we have this season, and they're awesome. I sleep on a Casper mattress every night, and gotta say, sleep really soundly.
Yeah?
Sleep really soundly. I sleep as soundly as Bran sleeps at the end of this episode.
Whoa.
Too soon?
Too soon.
I mean, he's in a coma, man. Like they have a freaking dream chapter in the book, if I'm not mistaken. Right?
Yeah, you know.
So, but point being,
I think Bran never would have woken up from that coma if he had the comfort of the Casper mattress.
That's right. I think that's true. So, thanks to Casper for sponsoring us. We hope if you are considering a mattress, you'll use Casper.com/acastofkings and use promo code acastofkings to get $50 off your first mattress. So thanks so much, and let's move on, John Robinson. So we're talking about the feast scene, and we have all this little dialogue here. We got Benjen and John talking in the courtyard, and John meeting Tyrion, and all this stuff I think is pretty much straight from the book, right? A lot of stuff, just the dialogue is lifted from the book. Love the scene between Jon and Tyrion, right? Kind of establishing the whole bastard and dwarf relationship.
Yeah.
Very interesting.
There's a stupid thing that happens in the book that I'm so glad they left out of the show,
which is
that Tyrion like hands brings off a little wall, like, you know, he's sitting on a wall and John's like, do you need help down? Tyrion's like, no. And he does a somersault in the air and a hand backspring and lands because he's, I guess, a gymnastic dwarf. And it's it would look very silly.
He also meets John's direwolf in the book, which doesn't happen here. And yeah, I mean, essentially what happens is they have so much stuff they need to get through in this episode. They look at the book, they look at everything that happens in the book, and they just cut out anything that's not crucial to establishing who these characters are or the relationship between them or what they're supposed to do. And
sometimes they make other cuts.
Yeah, although they did add something in, right? They added in this scene with Cersei and Sansa. I don't think that was in the book, right? With when she says, like, have you bled yet? Was that in the book? I don't think that was in the book.
No.
Yeah, so... but I like that scene because it shows how...
It gives Cersei some more lines in this episode.
It gives Cersei some more lines and kind of shows what kind of person she is.
Yeah.
She doesn't stand on ceremony, Cersei. And she doesn't care if she offends you... or if she needs to tear you to shreds in some way, she's just going to do it.
Yep.
And yeah, I think when I was first watching the show, the sort of whole concept of this being the North and this, you know, these being royal people walking into the North was a little bit lost on me. Because I guess in my mind, I had just said, oh, this is all just medieval people. Right, there's no difference between them. But watching it again, you realize kind of how out of sorts they are in this.
Well, how the King's Landing people think of the Northern people as country bumpkins.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And that's something I didn't grasp kind of the first time through this show. So,
right.
Anything else about the feast scene that we want to discuss?
No, I just, as you say, it's good economic, you know, you get like Arya throwing food and then like really cute, like Rob picking her up and making her go to bed and like all, you know, the Stark kids are only together, all together for this episode and a little bit of the next episode. And so this is where you build the foundation of this is the Stark family. This is what they lost, right? You have to see it all right here.
Yep.
And I just think they do a really good job with it.
Excellent job of it. Yeah. Really great stuff. There is a scene. Did we talk about the scene between? I guess this happened earlier between Ned and Catelyn, right? Where there, you know, she tells him about.
Oh yeah, I forgot to write that down. Where she gets the note from.
She gets the note. And again, in the book, there is a secret code. Right. But they don't. They just do
a whole like level, like a secret box that it came with a lens. Yeah, all this.
And it's just like, oh, we don't need to do any of that. So
or all the like information about how her room is kept hot by the hot springs. Yeah, there's just like all this stuff that's just
excised, right? And I didn't miss it in the show.
Nope.
I didn't miss it. I just wanted to point out there is this kind of hilarious framing. It is great framing. It is framing that if I were ever blessed to make anything of this caliber, I would probably use. But there is this perfect framed scene where Ned is considering things, and over his right shoulder is Catelyn out of focus saying, oh, don't go. And then Master Luwin on his left shoulder is saying, but you're the only person that might be able to help Robert. You know, and it's kind of this like angels and demons sitting on his shoulder I thought was really great in this episode. Anyway, wanted to point that out because I guess – For Ned, it is a really difficult decision. I feel like it's more difficult in the book than it is in the show.
I think it's just clear in the book that he is leaving everything that he loves. Basically, like he's going to take his daughters and his youngest son with him, but he has to leave everything else that he cares about behind him.
Yeah,
and his family history there. You know, it's just. I do think that's a little clear in the books.
Yeah, yeah.
Because in the show, it's like, hey, this is a promotion, dude. Like, come on. This is great. Hand of the King. Well, and also in the book, they do a little better job of showing that the Hand of the King is a really crappy job, which you don't understand until a little later, I think.
Right, that's true.
Right. What do they say in the book? I think, like, the king eats and the hand takes the shit or something like that is a line from the book. So, yeah.
I think, I think that... one of the great things about the show is how they introduce certain concepts. And there's so many kind of big concepts that they need to introduce, and they try to do it in a very measured way. And this season, this idea of taking the black, just the phrase "take the black," cool phrase, and you kind of understand what it is. In this episode, conveys really well what it is. I feel like the book just introduces like all these things, like creatures that you don't understand, and they're throwing stuff at you left and right. And I feel like the show is a lot more careful about how much the audience can comprehend at any one time. Do you know what I mean? But maybe that's just me.
No, you have to seed this stuff in. It's a lot of world building right off the bat. I mean, so I don't know if I've ever told this anecdote on this podcast before, but when I first picked up the first Game of Thrones book and you have the cold open, and I thought the others were vampires. Like, I didn't really know anything. You know, this is before the TV show, and I didn't really know anything. Uh-huh. And, you know, so they mentioned these, like, figures gliding effortlessly in the woods or whatever. And I was like, are these vampires? What is this? And I was like, I don't care for this world building. And I put it down, and I didn't pick the book up again until much later. Wow. So, you know, my mistake. But, like, sometimes world building can just be too much, too oppressive, and you have to be really careful with how you do it. So.
Agreed, and I think the show does it really well. And I think,
I think the book does it well too. I guess, was not in the mood that day, but you know, the show doesn't have the luxury the book does.
Well, the book is more challenging. I just think the book is more challenging when it comes to world building, and it's very difficult for me to conceive of enjoying this book without having watched the show. I just think it would be overwhelming. Just too much stuff. We're skipping around because we forgot to talk about a lot of stuff earlier on, actually. But one of the things we forgot to mention is Dany meeting Khal Drogo, right?
Yeah.
So they meet in this episode, and you get a little bit of Viserys's how ruthless he is, right? About how he'd
let everyone in the Khalasar have their turn with her if it meant getting his throne. Yeah.
What was really interesting to me reading the book is how kind of the differences between Khal Drogo in the book and him in the show.
Uh-huh.
Because in the book they talk about, like, I think he has like a castle, like, or a palace, right?
Yeah.
Whereas in the show, he's very much like a nomadic, you know, what are they called?
The Dothraki?
The Dothraki, right. They feel like they're nomadic people. And they're kind of – in the book, he's described as having more like accoutrement, you know, like more jewelry and stuff like that, whereas they're kind of savages in the show.
Yeah, but I mean they call them barbarians in the book. They are the horse people. Like, they do move around but he does have a castle that the people of Pentos gave to him, basically.
Right.
I'm not sure every Khal has a castle, you know?
Right.
So, but yeah, they go to dinner at Khal Drogo's house, which is kind of crazy.
Which is not something you could ever imagine happening in the show.
Khal Drogo's dinner party is a scene in the book, yeah.
Also, I just want to give a shout out to Maester Illyrio in the...
Well, it's not a maester.
I'm sorry. Magister Illyrio.
Magister Illyrio.
Sorry, my bad.
That's okay.
And who is he played by? He's played by a very well-regarded British actor.
I can't remember his name right now.
I'm going to look it up as we speak.
Okay.
But in the book, I guess it wasn't really clear to me from the book why Magister Illyrio was so kind to Viserys.
Right.
Because in the book, it's kind of clear, at least from my reading of it, that Magister Illyrio thinks Viserys is full of crap, right? Or doesn't fully believe what Viserys is – isn't fully buying what Viserys is selling.
Roger Allam,
right.
V for Vendetta.
Great actor.
Yeah.
Loved him in The Thick of It. He's fantastic in that. And sad that he's only – I think this is the only episode that he's in the whole season, the series, so thus far at least. In the book, do you know what I mean?
No, there's another scene later. We'll get to it.
One. But in the book, he's kind of it seems clear to me that Illyrio is not a huge fan of Viserys. Like, he doesn't really believe Viserys when he says Viserys says he's going to take over the world. Do you know what I mean?
In the books. Yeah,
right? Whereas in the show, it's much more ambiguous. And so I could buy, like, oh, here's why Magister Illyrio is helping everyone. Like, I could buy that. So I just thought that was a little weird. Any take on that, Jonah?
You mean you buy it in the show, but you don't buy it in the books?
It was just a little bit confused in the books as to why he would be.
Well, that's intentional, I think, because we didn't find out until like this season of Game of Thrones, I think, that he's in cahoots with Varys, and it's all part of the Targaryen restoration, and it's this whole big thing. So I think his motivations are shadowy.
Mm. I did like this one line in the show that was really great, where he Viserys says something imprudent, and Illyrio says, "I wouldn't say that in front of the call if I were you." And he says, "Do you take me for a fool?" And he's like, "I take you for a king, and kings don't possess the caution of common men."
Illyrio is so good at scrambling to like find the right answer to give to Viserys, who's a psycho. You know, he's like, "Oh, I said the wrong thing to the psycho. Let me quickly," because he does it again later when they go to dinner at Khal Drogo's house, where like Viserys has his like a hand on his sword because he's like freaking out, and Illyrio's like, "Oh, it's for your protection because we know that you're constantly being hounded by, you know, the knives of the usurper or whatever it is that they say. You know, it's all for you, my lord. You are so important." So yeah,
great stuff. So anyway, Dany gets married this episode,
and she meets Ser Jorah.
Right, which. It didn't happen at the wedding in the book, right?
At the dinner party.
It happens at the dinner party, right. And so she meets Ser Jorah, gets the dragon eggs. Some we see a depiction of a Dothraki wedding during which there are murders. In the book, I think there's like 12 murders. So they really took it easy in the show. We only saw one murder on screen.
The dull affair,
And... I thought the wedding in general, you know, looked convincing overall, just like that this kind of other culture that you have. It's beautifully filmed on a beach. And then she gets a horse at the end of it, right?
Yeah.
Any other thoughts on the wedding scene?
No, I mean, I like the introduction to Jorah. I like that she gets books. You know, she gets a history book. She gets eggs. She gets a horse.
I like that the eggs weren't sparkly. I think that would have made it look a little bit weird.
Yeah, the way they're described in the book, they sound like almost like Fabergé eggs. Or right.
Sound like they're classy eggs in the show.
Yeah. Muted, understated.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Very good.
I will say her wedding night is a little – would you agree with me in saying that her wedding night is a little more consensual in the book than it seems in the show?
I think I would agree with you, yeah. I mean, she's not
– She literally says yes in the end of the chapter.
Right.
And she's not, weeping and being roughly taken from behind. So, yes.
The only thing I couldn't stop thinking about was in the show, in the books, I should say, Khal Drogo is supposed to have a ton of bells hanging from his hair. Yeah. And I was just thinking, man, they got rid of the bells of the show.
I know, the bells are kind of fun. They softly chime all the time.
There's a lot of practical reasons why you don't want one of your actors wearing bells all the time.
Yeah, true.
But yeah, I would agree with you. And the language play is interesting about how he keeps saying no in the books and in the show as well. I didn't appreciate that the first time I watched it, I guess because I was overtaken by the horror of what was actually happening.
And just your joy in Jason Momoa is like such good casting for Khal Drogo.
Everyone is good casting.
Everyone's
good casting. So. So then final scene in Winterfell, right? Ned and Robert, they go out for a hunt, and Bran decides to climb again and go climbing, and he starts hearing something. And in the books, this is way different, right? Like in the show, he wanders in on them while they're having sex.
Yeah.
And in the books, he hears like all this conversation.
Yeah, you get a lot of exposition. I think it's a little clunky. Bran doesn't know who he's listening to. I don't know. He's young, so.
Not only does he not know who he's listening to, he doesn't actually know what's going on. I thought that was interesting that they wrote it from the perspective of a child. So, they're wrestling, The man and woman were naked and wrestling each other.
Yeah, that's
true. Which I thought was both adorable and also horrifying given that it was being applied to this situation. But I did think it was interesting the differences. I agree, it's more clunky in the book.
And they gave some, like, Cersei and Jaime some of that conversation in the throne room earlier in the episode, right? So you get them having a conversation in the throne room, which establishes King's Landing. And so then here you don't have to have Bran just like listening to these two people talk for a really long time.
Yeah, in the show you just see them doing it doggy style.
Right.
And that's all you need. That's all you need. And the scene, I think the scene where he pushes him is very similar to the one in the book. He's just like, yeah, you know, the things I do for love pushes him. He saw us. I will say, I think it was more effective in the show. I think just on a very basic level, because you just this sounds stupid, but just seeing these actors in the roles, because basically the actors are referred to differently in the book, right? Because he doesn't call her Cersei or anything. He calls her the Queen. And just see, you know, having the continuity of seeing the actor, I feel like just helps my comprehension of what is going on and helps that scene to land more effectively for me.
That's true. I think it's a little more sophisticated in the book because, yeah, every time, in theory, every chapter, you're getting it from a different perspective, right?
So it's very expertly done in that.
Yeah.
In that
so you see Cersei as she appears to these other, you know, she's called the Lannister woman. Like Ned calls her the Lannister woman, you know, like blah, blah, blah. All these people have these like various attitudes towards her. And it's not even until like book four that we get inside her head. So, it's a really interesting device that Martin uses. But you're right that in the show, it just makes it more straightforward of like, this is Lena Headey. This is what she always looks like. That's what she always sounds
exactly.
like.
Exactly. You know? That's the woman who we saw earlier on. Very basic, like, you know, comprehension, object permanence, basically, is what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
It's a very, like, basic thing that makes the show easier to understand. So
what did you think of the two – like, so the two special effects – there's the one, the first time Bran's climbing around, and then the fall are like, I think the two big green screen moments that look a little rough. Yeah. And I mean, the White Walkers too in the beginning. I mean, I feel like those are obviously people and not CGI, but they're much darker. They're basically like in shadow. They're much darker. So like now they're using people to be the White Walker, like the Night's King and stuff like that, the Hardhome. Like those are people, mm-hmm. right? Now that they've armored them. But then there was a couple seasons in between where they were just like CGI confections mm-hmm. and they looked kind of weird. Anyway, whatever. My disorganized thoughts of the tracking of what the White Walkers look like over the different seasons.
It is interesting to see how certain things evolve in the show, things and how they look evolve in the show, and how they maintain continuity.
Yeah.
So he pushes them over, and then that's the end of the episode. So overall, you know, what did you think of this episode, Jonah Robinson?
I mean, what a great pilot. Yes. I mean, confusing if you don't know the story, I think. If you were just watching this one episode of television, you would somehow have been living in a bunker, never heard of Game of Thrones, never read any of the books. Like now in 2015, if you just came in, you would be confused, right? It's confusing. It's a lot of people and a lot of information.
But if you
know that Game of Thrones is a great show and you should stick with it, you'll get it. Or if you've read the books or if you know how to use a wiki, you'll be fine.
I don't know if I agree. I mean, I am not a smart man, Joanna. but I would say you grasp.
But I know what love is. Okay, sorry,
you grasp the fundamentals of what's happening here, which is Ned's honorable dude. Robert's this fat king and he's going and he's asking him for help. And Ned's very torn about it. Robert's wife is having sex with her brother. Those are the fundamental things that you need to understand, really. And I think the show conveyed those well. And of course, all the Dany Viserys stuff, that's pretty clear as well. Like, this Viserys guy thinks he's supposed to be the king, right? And so I think the basics are established really well in this episode. I would say later episodes get more complicated and more confusing.
Maybe.
For instance, I would say, like, Theon's role. What is he doing and how did he get there and all that stuff? That's not really established in this episode, right?
No.
You don't really understand
who
he is, right?
Yeah.
So that's one thing that – and I don't think the book even makes it very clear, right?
A little bit. They talk about it in the book.
I think one of the things that's cool about the book is that there's some things that the show makes easier to understand, like having an actor play a part.
Yeah.
And you see them in scene to scene. And there's some things that the book makes easier. Like, you understand why Jon Snow is called Jon Snow. They explain that in the book. Right.
Right.
Like, the Snow is a title for all bastards. And that's something that might have taken me many episodes, if not seasons, to fully understand.
I will say – yeah, sorry, go ahead.
No, you – so I'm just saying, like, there's – it's not as a one is significantly better than the other. It's just that they each are playing to their own strengths.
Absolutely, as in their medium, you know. I think my favorite chapter of what we read so far is John's chapter with the feast and then going out to the courtyard. It's such a good example of point of view chapters because he gets drunk, right? But he doesn't really know he's drunk. And he's really upset that he's been exiled to the back of the feasting room. But he's pretending that he's not. He's pretending that it's better there. And he's crying, but he's like, oh, there's a lot of smoke in here. It's making my eyes water. You know, like, he's really, really upset, but he's in, like, a quasi-unreliable narrator in that episode, in that chapter. And that's the stuff that's harder to do in the show. And, you know, not only do they not really, you know, they don't dedicate that much time to Jon Snow, they don't have time to give him that much of a scene. But also, you know, Kit Harington is just getting started. He's good in this episode, but he's not, like, I think when you read about Jon Snow in the book, you're immediately sort of more with him than you are in the show. And as you know, as a show watcher, Jon Snow becomes so – it's so important that you're with him on this journey, right? And so
– I don't know. I don't know. I think I was kind of with him to begin with. I mean, I think he has a – at least, again, spoiling episode two, but like, he has a great relationship with – Arya, you know what I mean?
And Bran in this episode too,
and
you know?
Bran, right, yeah, exactly.
He's the one who's like, you know, father will know if you look away, like all this sort of stuff. Like, yeah, you see his relationships. And I'm not saying Kit Harington is bad. I think Kit Harington is not great in some later episodes, but I don't think he's bad in this pilot. I just think, I mean, especially because Jon's younger in the book. He's younger, he's the bastard, he's treated poorly by Catelyn. Catelyn's way bitchier in the book about him than she is in the show so far. And I don't know. There's just something about, like, poor, drunk, young Jon Snow crying, you know, it really got me. So
Fair enough. I think that was a good chapter as well. But yeah, I would say something about Jon's character really resonated with me this time around in the show. And so I really appreciated kind of, you know, he feels like he doesn't really belong in this place. And who among us hasn't felt that way? So, liked all of his work. We didn't really talk that much about Benjen because I guess I still remember how pissed you were. Or not even pissed, but just how genius that HBO trolling was.
HBO got me so hard. Season,
when they thought, when we all thought Benjen might actually return.
Yeah.
So freaking brilliant.
That was so great when in this episode though, when like he comes in the courtyard and Jon Snow's like, Uncle Benjen. I'm like, oh, that's what Jon Snow was expecting to happen in the season finale of season 5. He'd go into the courtyard and be like, Uncle Benjen. except Ollie's an asshole. So what was I gonna say? Yeah, Benjen comes in and, like, you know, gives Ned some information about what's going on the wall, I think, and basically he's just there to take Jon away. But I love that actor. I mean, I think they cast him really well. He looks like Sean Bean's brother. Benjen Stark.
So I got very confused at this very basic plot point early on about how the guy who they executed in the show is the same guy that, you know, was confronting the White Walkers in the cold open.
Yeah.
And in my mind, when I read the book, I thought, oh, well, it's not the same guy. Or at least they're certainly not describing him the same way. But I guess I just missed that detail. But the question that came up for me was then, how did that person get south of the wall? Do you know what I mean?
Well, I think the better question in the show is, how did that guy get away from the White Walkers? I mean, right. We've seen the White Walkers just sort of, I mean, didn't we see them look at Sam
just
and then
walked past
going?
Sam.
Yeah, so occasionally they're just like, not today, not you.
It's not your day yet.
You know, so we don't know how that guy got away from the White Walkers. And, you know, if he came back through, like, let's say he comes back through the gate, there are ways through. Anyway, what if he came back through the gate and was just like, oh, it's fine, everything's fine, I'm gonna go take a shower.
Oh, yeah.
And then, like, peace,
yep,
I'm out of
exactly.
here.
Just took you off. Know? Yeah.
Yeah. where are the guys who are with you? Oh, they're right behind me. I just got here first. Need a shower. I'll be back.
But I did think it was interesting that for a show watcher who doesn't comprehend the geography of the land,
yeah,
it totally makes sense. Like, you know, scene A leads to scene B where the guy's running away and then he's found. Like, that makes complete sense. Whereas now that I know more about the show, I'm asking the question, how did he get south of the wall? What happened there? You know, how did he survive the, you know, all these questions that come up that I just might not have had if I was just watching the show. You know? So that expect that trend to continue as we watch.
Sounds good.
Any other thoughts before we wrap up on this episode, Jonah Robinson?
No, I think that's it. This is so fun talking to you about a book.
Yes.
And I hope everyone's having fun reading along or at least listening to us talk about this and watching along. So.
Yes. I hope everyone's enjoying themselves and also supporting our sponsors.
Yes.
We'd greatly appreciate it. But in any case, so that's what we're going to be doing this whole season. And so, Joanna, what do people need to read through for next time? Do you have that information?
We have to read up through Daenerys's third chapter, but I don't have the page number for that.
All right. So through the next Daenerys chapter.
Yeah.
Well, we will see you guys next week with another episode of A Cast of Kings covering season one, episode two, through Daenerys's third chapter in A Game of Thrones. In the meantime, Joanna, where can people find more of your work on the internet this week?
You can still find me writing about Game of Thrones, to be perfectly honest with you, on vanityfair.com. You can follow me on Twitter at Joe Wrote This. You can listen to me talk about comic books on the Thought Bubble podcast or TV in general on the Station Agents podcast.
Find my work at davechen.net, on Twitter at davechensky, and my directorial debut is available on all video on demand platforms right now. It's called The Primary Instinct. You can find it at theprimaryinstinct.com. Hope you'll consider checking that out, as a lot of work went into it. Thanks for listening. We'll see you guys next week.